and said,
"Roads go ever on and on, under rock and under tree, by caves where never sun has shone, by streams that never find the sea, over snow by winter sown, and through the merry flowers of June, over grass and over stone, and under mountains in the moon. Roads go ever, ever on, under cloud and under star, yet feet that wandering have gone turn at last to home afar. Eyes that fire and sword have seen, and horror in the halls of stone, look at last on meadows green, and trees and hills they long have known."
Gandalf looked at him. "My dear Bilbo," he said, "something is the matter with you. You are not the hobbit that you were."
And so they crossed the bridge and passed the mill by the river and came right back to Bilbo's own door.
"Bless me, what's going on?" he cried.
There was a great commotion, and people of all sorts, respectable and unrespectable, were thick round the door, and many were going in and out, not even wiping their feet on the mat, as Bilbo noticed with annoyance. If he was surprised, they were more surprised still. He had arrived back in the middle of an auction. There was a large notice in black and red hung on the gate, stating that on June the 22nd, Messrs. Grubb, and Burrows would sell by auction the effects of the late Bilbo Baggins Esquire, a Bagend, Underhill, Hobbiton. Sale to commence at 10 o'clock sharp. It was now nearly lunchtime, and most of the things had already been sold, for various prices from next to nothing to old songs, as is not unusual at auctions. Bilbo's cousins, the Sackville Bagginses, were, in fact, busy measuring his rooms to see if their own furniture would fit. In short, Bilbo was presumed dead, and not everybody that said so was sorry to find the presumption wrong. The return of Mr. Bilbo Baggins created quite a disturbance, both under the hill and over the hill, and across the water. It was a great deal more than a 9 days' wonder. The legal bother, indeed, lasted for years. It was quite a long time before Mr. Baggins was, in fact, admitted to be alive again. The people who had got specially good bargains at the sale took a deal of convincing, and in the end, to save time, Bilbo had to buy back quite a lot of his own furniture. Many of his silver spoons mysteriously disappeared and were never accounted for. Personally, he suspected the Sackville Bagginses. On their side, they never admitted that the returned Baggins was genuine, and they were not on friendly terms with Bilbo ever after. They really had wanted to live in his nice hobbit hole so very much. Indeed, Bilbo found he had lost more than spoons. He had lost his reputation. It is true that for ever after he remained an elf friend, and had the honour of the dwarves, wizards, and all such folk as ever passed that way. But he was no longer quite respectable. He was, in fact, held by all the hobbits of the neighbourhood to be queer, except by his nephews and nieces on the Took side. But even they were not encouraged in their friendship by their elders. I'm sorry to say he didn't mind. He was quite content, and the sound of the kettle on his hearth was ever after more musical than it had been even in the quiet days before the unexpected party. His sword he hung over the mantelpiece. His coat of mail was arranged on a stand in the hall until he lent it to a museum. His gold and silver was largely spent in presents, both useful and extravagant, which to a certain extent accounts for the affection of his nephews and his nieces. His magic ring he kept a great secret, for he chiefly used it when unpleasant callers came. He took to writing poetry and visiting the elves, and though many shook their heads and touched their foreheads and said, "Poor old Baggins," and though few believed any of his tales, he remained very happy to the end of his days, and those were extraordinarily long. One autumn evening, some years afterwards, Bilbo was sitting in his study, writing his memoirs. He thought of calling them "There and Back Again, A Hobbit's Holiday," when there was a ring at the door. It was Gandalf and a dwarf, and the dwarf was actually Balin. "Come in! Come in!" said Bilbo, and soon they were settled in chairs by the fire. If Balin noticed that Mr. Baggins's waistcoat was more extensive and had real gold buttons, Bilbo also noticed that Balin's beard was several inches longer, and his jewelled belt was of great magnificence. They fell to talking of their times together, of course, and Bilbo asked how things were going in the lands of the mountain. It seemed they were going very well. Bard had rebuilt the town in Dale, and men had gathered to him from the lake and from south and west, and all the valley had become tilled again and rich, and the desolation was now filled with birds and blossoms in spring, and fruit and feasting in autumn. And Lake Town was refounded, and was more prosperous than ever, and much wealth went up and down the running river, and there was friendship in those parts between elves and dwarves and men. The old master had come to a bad end. Bard had given him much gold for the help of the lake people, but being of the kind that easily catches such disease, he fell under the dragon sickness, and took most of the gold and fled with it, and died of starvation in the waste, deserted by his companions. "The new master is of wiser kind," said Balin, "and very popular, for, of course, he gets most of the credit for the present prosperity. They are making songs which say that in his day the rivers ran with gold." "Then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true, after a fashion," said Bilbo.
"Of course," said Gandalf. "And why should not they prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself? You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck, just for your sole benefit? You're a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I'm very fond of you, but you're only quite a little fellow in a wide world, after all."
"Thank goodness," said Bilbo, laughing, and handed him the tobacco jar.
The end. You've been listening to The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated by Rob Inglis. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Lord of the Rings, J.R.R. Tolkien's monumental trilogy, performed unabridged by Rob Inglis. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order The Fellowship of the Ring, the first book in the trilogy, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. The Hobbit, Disc 2.
At first they had passed through Hobbit lands, a wild, respectable country inhabited by decent folk, with good roads, an inn or two, and now and then a dwarf or a farmer ambling by on business. Then they came to lands where people spoke strangely, and sang songs Bilbo had never heard before. Now they had gone on far into the Lone Lands, where there were no people left, no inns, and the roads grew steadily worse. Not far ahead were dreary hills, rising higher and higher, dark with trees. On some of them were old castles with an evil look, as if they had been built by wicked people. Everything seemed gloomy, for the weather that day had taken a nasty turn. Mostly it had been as good as May can be, even in merry tales, but now it was cold and wet. In the Lone Lands they had to camp when they could, but at least it had been dry. "To think it will soon be June," grumbled Bilbo as he splashed along behind the others in a very muddy track. It was after tea time. It was pouring with rain, and had been all day. His hood was dripping into his eyes, his cloak was full of water, the pony was tired and stumbled on stones, the others were too grumpy to talk. "And I'm sure the rain has got into the dry clothes and into the food bags," thought Bilbo. "Bother burgling and everything to do with it. I wish I was at home in my nice hole by the fire with the kettle just beginning to sing." It was not the last time that he wished that. Still the dwarves jogged on, never turning round or taking any notice of the hobbit. Somewhere behind the grey clouds the sun must have gone down, for it began to get dark. Wind got up, and the willows along the river bank bent and sighed. I don't know what river it was, a rushing red one, swollen with the rains of the last few days that came down from the hills and mountains in front of them. Soon it was nearly dark. The winds broke up the grey clouds, and a waning moon appeared above the hills between the flying rags. Then they stopped, and Thorin muttered something about supper.
"And where shall we get a dry patch to sleep on?"
Not until then did they notice that Gandalf was missing. So far he'd come all the way with them, never saying if he was in the adventure or merely keeping them company for a while. He had eaten most, talked most, and laughed most, but now he simply was not there at all.
"Just when a wizard would have been most useful, too," groaned Dori and Nori, who shared the hobbit's views about regular meals, plenty and often. They decided in the end that they would have to camp where they were. So far they had not camped before on this journey, and though they knew that they soon would have to camp regularly, when they were among the misty mountains and far from the lands of respectable people, it seemed a bad wet evening to begin on. They moved to a clump of trees, and though it was drier under them, the wind shook the rain off the leaves, and the drip, drip was most annoying. Also the mischief seemed to have got into the fire. Dwarves can make a fire almost anywhere out of almost anything, wind or no wind. But they could not do it that night, not even Oin and Gloin, who were specially good at it. Then one of the ponies took fright at nothing and bolted. He got into the river before they could catch him, and before they could get him out again, Feely and Keely were nearly drowned, and all the baggage that he carried was washed away off him. Of course it was mostly food, and there was mighty little left for supper and less for breakfast. There they all sat glum and wet and muttering, while Oin and Gloin went on trying to light the fire, and quarrelling about it. Bilbo was sadly reflecting that adventures are not all pony rides in May sunshine, when Balin, who was always their lookout man, said,
"There's a light over there."
There was a hill some way off with trees on it, pretty thick in parts. Out of the dark mass of the trees they could now see a light shining, a reddish, comfortable-looking light, as if it might be a fire or torches twinkling. When they had looked at it for some time, they fell to arguing. Some said no, and some said yes. Some said they could but go and see, and anything was better than little supper, less breakfast, and wet clothes all the night. Others said,
"These parts are none too well known, and are too near the mountains. Travellers seldom come this way now. The old maps are no use. Things have changed for the worse, and the road is unguarded. They have seldom ever heard of the king around here, and the less inquisitive you are as you go along, the less trouble you're likely to find." Some said, "After all, there are 14 of us." Others said, "Where's Gandalf got to?"
This remark was repeated by everybody. Then the rain began to pour down worse than ever, and Oin and Gloin began to fight. That settled it.
"After all, we have got a burglar with us," they said,
and so they made off, leading their ponies, with all due and proper caution, in the direction of the light. They came to the hill and were soon in the wood. Up the hill they went, but there was no proper path to be seen, such as might lead to a house or a farm, and do what they could they made a deal of rustling and crackling and creaking, and a good deal of grumbling and dratting, as they went through the trees in the pitch dark. Suddenly the red light shone out very bright through the tree trunks not far ahead.
"Now it is the burglar's turn," they said, meaning Bilbo. "You must go on and find out all about the light, and what it's for, and if all is perfectly safe and canny," said Thorin to the hobbit. "Now scuttle off, and come back quick if all is well. If not, come back if you can. If you can't, hoot twice like a barn owl and once like a screech owl, and we'll do what we can."
Off Bilbo had to go. Before he could explain that he could not hoot even once like any kind of owl any more than fly like a bat. But at any rate, hobbits can move quietly in woods, absolutely quietly. They take a pride in it, and Bilbo had sniffed more than once at what he called all this dwarvish racket as they went along, though I don't suppose you or I would notice anything at all on a windy night, not if the whole cavalcade had passed 2 feet off. As for Bilbo walking primly towards the red light, I don't suppose even a weasel would have stirred a whisker at it. So, naturally, he got right up to the fire, for fire it was, without disturbing anyone. And this is what he saw. 3 very large persons sitting round a very large fire of beech logs. They were toasting mutton on long spits of wood, and licking the gravy off their fingers. There was a fine, toothsome smell. Also, there was a barrel of good drink at hand, and they were drinking out of jugs. But they were trolls. Obviously trolls. Even Bilbo, in spite of his sheltered life, could see that. From the great, heavy faces of them, and their size, and the shape of their legs, not to mention their language, which was not drawing-room fashion at all.
"Mutton yesterday, mutton today, and blimey, if it don't look like mutton again tomorrow," said one of the trolls.
"Never a blinking bit of man flesh if we had for long enough," said a second. "What the hell William was a-thinking of to bring us into these parts at all beats me, and the drink running short what's more," he said, jogging the elbow of William, who was taking a pull at his jug. William choked.
"Such a mouth," he said as soon as he could. "You can't expect folk to stop here forever just to be hit by you and Bert. You've had a village and a half between you since we come down from the mountains. How much more do you want?
and time's been up our way when you'd have said, "Thank you, Bill, for a nice bit of fat valley mutton like what this is." He took a big bite off a sheep's leg he was toasting and wiped his lips on his sleeve. "Yes, I am afraid trolls do behave like that, even those with only one head each." After hearing all this, Bilbo ought to have done something at once. Either he should have gone back quietly and warned his friends that there were three fair-sized trolls at hand in a nasty mood, quite likely to try Toasted Dwarf, or even Pony, for a change, or else he should have done a bit of good, quick burgling. A really first-class and legendary burglar would at this point have picked the troll's pockets. It is nearly always worthwhile, if you can manage it. Pinched the very mutton off the spits, purloined the beer, and walked off without their noticing him. Others more practical, but with less professional pride, would perhaps have stuck a dagger into each of them before they observed it. Then the night could have been spent cheerily. Bilbo knew it. He had read a good many things he had never seen or done. He was very much alarmed as well as disgusted. He wished himself 100 miles away, and yet somehow he could not go straight back to Thorin and Company empty-handed. So he stood and hesitated in the shadows. Of the various burglarious proceedings he had heard of, picking the troll's pockets seemed the least difficult. So at last he crept behind a tree just behind William. Bert and Tom went off to the barrel. William was having another drink. Then Bilbo plucked up courage and put his little hand in William's enormous pocket. There was a purse in it, as big as a bag to Bilbo. "Ha," thought he, warming to his new work as he lifted it carefully out. "This is a beginning." It was. Trolls' purses are the mischief, and this was no exception.
"Here, who are you?"
it squeaked as it left the pocket, and William turned round at once and grabbed Bilbo by the neck before he could duck behind the tree.
"Blimey, Bert, look what I've copped," said William.
"What is it?"
said the others, coming up.
"Lummy, have I knows? What are you?"
"Bilbo Baggins, a hobbit," said poor Bilbo, shaking all over, and wondering how to make owl noises before they throttled him.
"A burr a hobbit?"
said they, a bit startled. Trolls are slow in the uptake, and mighty suspicious about anything new to them.
"What's a burr a hobbit got to do with my pocket anyways?"
said William.
"And can you cook 'em?"
said Tom.
"You can try," said Bert, picking up a skewer.
"He wouldn't make above a mouthful,"
said William, who had already had a fine supper.
"Not when he was skinned and boned."
"Perhaps there are more like him round about, and we might make a pie," said Bert.
"You, are there any more of your sort of sneaking in these here woods, you nasty little rabbit?"
said he, looking at the hobbit's furry feet. And he picked him up by the toes and shook him.
"Yes, lots," said Bilbo,
before he remembered not to give his friends away.
No, none at all, not one," he said immediately afterwards.
"What do you mean?"
said Bert, holding him right way up, by the hair this time.
"What I say," said Bilbo, gasping, "and please don't cook me, kind sirs. I'm a good cook myself, and cook better than I cook, if you see what I mean. I'll cook beautifully for you, a perfectly beautiful breakfast for you, if only you won't have me for supper."
"Poor little blighter," said William.
He had already had as much supper as he could hold. Also, he had had lots of beer.
"Poor little blighter, let him go."
"Not till he says what he means by lots and none at all," said Bert. "I don't want to have me throat cut in me sleep.
hold his toes in the fire till he talks.
I won't have it, said William. I caught him anyway.
You're a fat fool, William, said Bert, as I've said afore this evening.
And you're a lout.
And I won't take that from you, Bill Huggins, said Bert, and put his fist in William's eye.
Then there was a gorgeous row. Bilbo had just enough wits left, when Bert dropped him on the ground, to scramble out of the way of their feet before they were fighting like dogs and calling one another all sorts of perfectly true and applicable names in very loud voices. Soon they were locked in one another's arms and rolling nearly into the fire, kicking and thumping, while Tom whacked at them both with a branch to bring them to their senses, and that, of course, only made them madder than ever. That would have been the time for Bilbo to have left, but his poor little feet had been very squashed in Bert's big paw, and he had no breath in his body, and his head was going round, so there he lay for a while, panting, just outside the circle of firelight. Right in the middle of the fight up came Balin. The dwarves had heard noises from a distance, and after waiting for some time for Bilbo to come back, or to hoot like an owl, they started off one by one to creep towards the light as quietly as they could. No sooner did Tom see Balin come into the light than he gave an awful howl. Trolls simply detest the very sight of dwarves uncooked. Bert and Bill stopped fighting immediately, and,
"A sack, Tom, quick," they said, before Balin, who was wondering where in all this commotion Bilbo was, knew what was happening. A sack was over his head, and he was down.
"There's more to come yet," said Tom, "or I mighty mistook. Lots and none at all it is," said he. "No borough hobbits, but lots of these here dwarves. That's about the shape of it."
"I reckon you're right," said Bert, "and we'd best get out of the light."
And so they did. With sacks in their hands, that they used for carrying off mutton and other plunder, they waited in the shadows. As each dwarf came up and looked at the fire, and the spilled jugs, and the gnawed mutton in surprise, pop! Went a nasty, smelly sack over his head, and he was down. Soon Dwalin lay by Balin, and Feely and Keely together, and Dori and Nori and Ori all in a heap, and Oin and Gloin and Bifer and Bofer and Bomber piled uncomfortably near the fire.
"That'll teach 'em," said Tom,
for Bifer and Bomber had given a lot of trouble and fought like mad, as dwarves will when cornered. Thorin came last, and he was not caught unawares. He came expecting mischief, and didn't need to see his friend's legs sticking out of sacks to tell him that things were not all well. He stood outside in the shadows some way off and said,
"What's all this trouble? Who's been knocking my people about?"
"It's trolls," said Bilbo from behind a tree. They'd forgotten all about him.
"They're hiding in the bushes with sacks," said he.
"Oh, are they?"
said Thorin, and he jumped forward to the fire before they could leap on him. He caught up a big branch all on fire at one end, and Bert got that end in his eye before he could step aside. That put him out of the battle for a bit. Bilbo did his best. He caught hold of Tom's leg, as well as he could. It was thick as a young tree trunk. But he was sent spinning up into the top of some bushes when Tom kicked the sparks up in Thorin's face. Tom got the branch in his teeth for that, and lost one of the front ones. It made him howl, I can tell you. But just at that moment, William came up behind and popped a sack right over Thorin's head and down to his toes. And so the fight ended. A nice pickle they were all in now, all neatly tied up in sacks, with three angry trolls, and two with burns and bashes to remember, sitting by them, arguing whether they should roast them slowly, or mince them fine and boil them, or just sit on them one by one and squash them into jelly. And Bilbo up in a bush with his clothes and his skin torn, not daring to move for fear they should hear him. It was just then that Gandalf came back, but no one saw him. The trolls had just decided to roast the dwarves now and eat them later. That was Bert's idea, and after a lot of argument, they'd all agreed to it.
"No good roasting 'em now. It'd take all night," said a voice.
Bert thought it was William's.
"Don't start the argument all over again, Bill," he said, "or it'll take all night."
"Who's arguing?" said William, who thought it was Bert that had spoken.
"You are,"
said Bert.
"You're a liar," said William,
and so the argument began all over again. In the end, they decided to mince them fine and boil them. So they got a black pot, and they took out their knives.
"No good boiling 'em. We ain't got no water, and it's a long way to the well and all," said a voice.
Bert and William thought it was Tom's.
"Shut up," said they, "or we'll never have done. And you can fetch the water yourself if you say any more."
"Shut up yourself," said Tom,
who had thought it was William's voice.
"Who's arguing but you, I'd like to know?" "You're a booby," said William.
"Booby yourself," said Tom.
And so the argument began all over again and went on hotter than ever, until at last they decided to sit on the sacks one by one and squash them and boil them next time.
"Who shall we sit on first?" said the voice.
"Better sit on the last fella first," said Bert,
whose eye had been damaged by Thorin. He thought Tom was talking.
"Don't talk to yourself," said Tom. "But if you wants to sit on the last one, sit on him. Which is he?"
"The one with the yellow stockings," said Bert.
"Nonsense. The one with the grey stockings," said a voice like William's.
"I made sure it was yellow," said Bert.
"Yellow it was," said William.
"Then what did you say it was grey for?" said Bert.
"I never did. Tom said it was."
"That I never did," said Tom. "It was you."
2-1, so shut your mouth," said Bert.
"Who are you talking to?" said William.
"Now stop it," said Tom and Bert together. "The night's getting on, and dawn comes early. Let's get on with it."
"Dawn take you all and be stoned to you,"
said a voice that sounded like William's, but it wasn't. For just at that moment the light came over the hill, and there was a mighty twitter in the branches. William never spoke, for he stood turned to stone as he stooped, and Bert and Tom were stuck like rocks as they looked at him. And there they stand to this day, all alone, unless the birds perch on them. For trolls, as you probably know, must be underground before dawn, or they go back to the stuff of the mountains they are made of, and never move again. That is what had happened to Bert and Tom and William.
"Excellent," said Gandalf, as he stepped from behind a tree and helped Bilbo to climb down out of the thorn bush. Then Bilbo understood. It was the wizard's voice that had kept the trolls bickering and quarrelling until the light came and made an end of them. The next thing was to untie the sacks and let out the dwarves. They were nearly suffocated and very annoyed. They had not at all enjoyed lying there listening to the trolls making plans for roasting them and squashing them and mincing them. They had to hear Bilbo's account of what had happened to him twice over before they were satisfied.
"Silly time to go practicing pinching and pocket-picking," said Bomber, "when what we wanted was fire and food. And that's just what you wouldn't have got of those fellows without a struggle in any case," said Gandalf. "Anyhow, you're wasting time now. Don't you realize that the trolls must have a cave or a hole dug somewhere near to hide from the sun in? We must look into it." They searched about
and soon found the marks of Troll's stony boots going away through the trees. They followed the tracks up the hill until, hidden by bushes, they came on a big door of stone leading to a cave. But they couldn't open it, not though they all pushed while Gandalf tried various incantations.
"Would this be any good?" asked Bilbo, when they were getting tired and angry. "I found it on the ground where the trolls had their fight."
He held out a largish key, though no doubt William had thought it very small and secret. It must have fallen out of his pocket, very luckily, before he was turned to stone.
"Why on earth didn't you mention it before?" they cried.
Gandalf grabbed it and fitted it into the keyhole. Then the stone door swung back with one big push, and they all went inside. There were bones on the floor, and a nasty smell was in the air. But there was a good deal of food jumbled carelessly on shelves and on the ground, among an untidy litter of plunder, of all sorts from brass buttons to pots full of gold coins standing in a corner. There were lots of clothes, too, hanging on the walls. Too small for trolls, I am afraid they belonged to victims, and among them were several swords of various makes, shapes, and sizes. Two caught their eyes particularly, because of their beautiful scabbards and jewelled hilts. Gandalf and Thorin each took one of these, and Bilbo took a knife in a leather sheath. It would have made only a tiny pocket knife for a troll, but it was as good as a short sword for the hobbit.
"These look like good blades," said the wizard, half drawing them and looking at them curiously. "They were not made by any troll, nor by any smith among men in these parts and days, but when we can read the runes on them, we shall know more about them."
"Let's get out of this horrible smell," said Feely.
So they carried out the pots of coins, and such food as was untouched and looked fit to eat, also one barrel of ale which was still full. By that time they felt like breakfast, and being very hungry, they didn't turn their noses up at what they had got from the troll's larder. Their own provisions were very scanty. Now they had bread and cheese and plenty of ale and bacon to toast in the embers of the fire. After that they slept, for their night had been disturbed, and they did nothing more till the afternoon. Then they brought up their ponies and carried away the pots of gold and buried them very secretly, not far from the track by the river, putting a great many spells over them, just in case they ever had the chance to come back and recover them. When that was done, they all mounted once more and jogged along again on the path towards the east.
"Where did you go to, if I may ask?" said Thorin to Gandalf as they rode along.
"To look ahead,"
said he.
"And what brought you back in the nick of time?"
"Looking behind,"
said he.
"Exactly," said Thorin. "But could you be more plain?"
"I went on to spy out our road. It will soon become dangerous and difficult. Also, I was anxious about replenishing our small stock of provisions. I had not gone very far, however, when I met a couple of friends of mine from Rivendell."
"Where's that?" asked Bilbo.
"Don't interrupt," said Gandalf. "You will get there in a few days now, if we're lucky, and find out all about it. As I was saying, I met two of Elrond's people. They were hurrying along for fear of the trolls. It was they who told me that three of them had come down from the mountains and settled in the woods not far from the road. They had frightened everyone away from the district, and they waylaid strangers. I immediately had a feeling that I was wanted back. Looking behind, I saw a fire in the distance and made for it. So now you know. Please be more careful next time, or we shall never get anywhere."
"Thank you," said Thorin.
Chapter 3. A Short Rest. They didn't sing or tell stories that day, even though the weather improved, nor the next day, nor the day after. They'd begun to feel that danger was not far away on either side. They camped under the stars, and their horses had more to eat than they had, for there was plenty of grass, but there was not much in their bags, even with what they had got from the trolls. One morning they forded a river at a wide, shallow place full of the noise of stones and foam. The far bank was steep and slippery. When they got to the top of it, leading their ponies, they saw that the great mountains had marched down very near to them. Already they seemed only a day's easy journey from the feet of the nearest. Dark and drear it looked, though there were patches of sunlight on its brown sides, and behind its shoulders the tips of snow peaks gleamed. "Is that the mountain?" asked Bilbo in a solemn voice, looking at it with round eyes. He'd never seen a thing that looked so big before.
"Of course not," said Balin. "That's only the beginning of the Misty Mountains, and we've got to get through or over or under those somehow before we can come into Wilderland beyond. And it's a deal of a way even from the other side of them to the lonely mountain in the east where Smaug lies on our treasures."
"Oh," said Bilbo, and just at that moment he felt more tired than he ever remembered feeling before. He was thinking once again of his comfortable chair before the fire, in his favourite sitting room in his hobbit hole, and of the kettle singing. Not for the last time. Now Gandalf led the way.
"We must not miss the road, or we shall be done for," he said. "We need food, for one thing, and rest in reasonable safety. Also, it's very necessary to tackle the Misty Mountains by the proper path, or else you'll get lost in them, and have to come back and start at the beginning again, if you ever get back at all."
They asked him where he was making for, and he answered,
"You are come to the very edge of the wild, as some of you may know. Hidden somewhere ahead of us is the fair valley of Rivendell where Elrond lives in the last homely house. I sent a message by my friends, and we're expected."
That sounded nice and comforting. But they had not got there yet, and it was not so easy as it sounds to find the last homely house west of the mountains. There seemed to be no trees and no valleys and no hills to break the ground in front of them. Only one vast slope going slowly up and up to meet the feet of the nearest mountain. A wide land the colour of heather and crumbling rock, with patches and slashes of grass green and moss green showing where water might be. Morning passed, afternoon came, but in all the silent waste there was no sign of any dwelling. They were growing anxious, for they now saw that the house might be hidden almost anywhere between them and the mountains. They came on unexpected valleys, narrow with deep sides, that opened suddenly at their feet, and they looked down surprised to see trees below them and running water at the bottom. There were gullies that they could almost leap over, but very deep with waterfalls in them. There were dark ravines that one could neither jump nor climb into. There were bogs, some of them green, pleasant places to look at, with flowers growing bright and tall, but a pony that walked there with a pack on its back would never have come out again. It was indeed a much wider land from the ford to the mountains than ever you would have guessed. Bilbo was astonished. The only path was marked with white stones, some of which were small, and others were half covered with moss or heather. Altogether, it was a very slow business following the track, even guided by Gandalf, who seemed to know his way about pretty well. His head and beard wagged this way and that as he looked for the stones, and they followed his head, but they seemed no nearer to the end of the search when the day began to fail. Tea time had long gone by, and it seemed supper time would soon do the same. There were moths fluttering about, and the light became very dim, for the moon had not risen. Bilbo's pony began to stumble over roots and stones. They came to the edge of a steep fall in the ground so suddenly that Gandalf's horse nearly slipped down the slope.
"Here it is at last," he called,
and the others gathered round him and looked over the edge. They saw a valley far below. They could hear the voice of hurrying water in a rocky bed at the bottom. The scent of trees was in the air, and there was a light on the valley side across the water. Bilbo never forgot the way they slithered and slipped in the dusk down the steep zigzag path into the secret valley of Rivendell. The air grew warmer as they got lower, and the smell of the pine trees made them drowsy, so that every now and again he nodded and nearly fell off, or bumped his nose on the pony's neck. Their spirits rose as they went down and down. The trees changed to beech and oak, and there was a comfortable feeling in the twilight. The last green had almost faded out of the grass when they came at length to an open glade not far above the banks of the stream.
It smells like elves, thought Bilbo, and he looked up at the stars. They were burning bright and blue. Just then there came a burst of song like laughter in the trees.
"Oh, what are you doing? And where are you going? Your ponies need shoeing, the river is flowing, oh, tra-la-la-lally, here down in the valley. Oh, what are you seeking, and where are you making? The faggots are reeking, the bannocks are baking, oh, trill-lilly-lolly, the valley is jolly, ha-ha. Oh, where are you going, with beards all a-wagging? No knowing, no knowing, what brings Mr. Baggins and Balin and Dwalin down into the valley in June? Ha-ha! Oh, will you be staying, or will you be flying? Your ponies are straying, the daylight is dying. To fly would be folly, to stay would be jolly, and listen and hark till the end of the dark to our tune, ha ha."
So they laughed and sang in the trees, and pretty fair nonsense, I dare say you think it. Not that they would care. They would only laugh all the more if you told them so. They were elves, of course. Soon Bilbo caught glimpses of them as the darkness deepened. He loved elves, though he seldom met them, but he was a little frightened of them, too. Dwarves don't get on well with them. Even decent enough dwarves like Thorin and his friends think them foolish, which is a very foolish thing to think, or get annoyed with them. For some elves tease them and laugh at them, and most of all at their beards.
"Well, well," said a voice, "just look. Bilbo the Hobbit on a pony, my dear, isn't it delicious?"
"Most astonishing, wonderful." Then off they went into another song as ridiculous as the one I've written down in full. At last one, a tall young fellow, came out from the trees and bowed to Gandalf and to Thorin.
"Welcome to the valley," he said.
"Thank you,"
said Thorin a bit gruffy. But Gandalf was already off his horse and among the elves, talking merrily with them.
"You are a little out of your way," said the elf. "That is, if you're making for the only path across the water and to the house beyond. We'll set you right, but you'd best get on foot until you're over the bridge. Are you going to stay a bit and sing with us, or will you go straight on? Supper is preparing over there," he said. "I can smell the wood fires for the cooking."
Tired as he was, Bilbo would have liked to stay a while. Elvish singing is not a thing to miss in June under the stars, not if you care for such things. Also, he would have liked to have a few private words with these people that seemed to know his name and all about him, although he'd never seen them before. He thought their opinion of his adventure might be interesting. Elves know a lot, and are wondrous folk for news, and know what's going on among the peoples of the land as quick as water flows, or quicker. But the dwarves were all for supper as soon as possible just then, and would not stay. On they all went, leading their ponies, till they were brought to a good path, and so at last to the very brink of the river. It was flowing fast and noisily, as mountain streams do of a summer evening, when sun has been all day on the snow far up above. There was only a narrow bridge of stone without a parapet, as narrow as a pony could well walk on, and over that they had to go, slow and careful, one by one, each leading his pony by the bridle. The elves had brought bright lanterns to the shore, and they sang a merry song as the party went across. "Don't dip your beard in the foam, father," they cried to Thorin, who was bent almost on to his hands and knees. "It's long enough without watering it." "Mind Bilbo doesn't eat all the cakes," they called. "He's too fat to get through keyholes yet."
"Hush, hush, good people, and good night," said Gandalf, who came last. "Valleys have ears, and some elves have over-merry tongues. Good night."
And so at last they all came to the last homely house, and found its doors flung wide. Now it is a strange thing, but things that are good to have, and days that are good to spend, are soon told about, and not much to listen to, while things that are uncomfortable, palpitating, and even gruesome, may make a good tale, and take a deal of telling anyway. They stayed long in that good house, 14 days at least, and they found it hard to leave. Bilbo would gladly have stopped there for ever and ever, even supposing a wish would have taken him right back to his hobbit hole without trouble. Yet there is little to tell about their stay. The master of the house was an elf friend, one of those people whose fathers came into the strange stories before the beginning of history, the wars of the evil goblins and the elves and the first men in the north. In those days of our tale, there were still some people who had both elves and heroes of the north for ancestors, and Elrond, the master of the house, was their chief. He was as noble and as fair in face as an elf lord, as strong as a warrior, as wise as a wizard, as venerable as a king of dwarves, and as kind as summer. He comes into many tales, but his part in the story of Bilbo's great adventures is only a small one, though important, as you'll see, if we ever get to the end of it. His house was perfect, whether you liked food, or sleep, or work, or storytelling, or singing, or just sitting and thinking best, or a pleasant mixture of them all. Evil things did not come into that valley. I wish I had time to tell you even a few of the tales or one or two of the songs that they heard in that house. All of them, the ponies as well, grew refreshed and strong in a few days there. Their clothes were mended as well as their bruises, their tempers and their hopes. Their bags were filled with food and provisions light to carry but strong to bring them over the mountain passes. Their plans were improved with the best advice. So the time came to Midsummer Eve, and they were to go on again with the early sun on Midsummer morning. Elrond knew all about runes of every kind. That day he looked at the swords they had brought from the troll's lair, and he said,
"These are not troll-make. They are old swords, very old swords of the High Elves of the West, my kin. They were made in Gondolin for the Goblin Wars. They must have come from a dragon's hoard or goblin plunder, for dragons and goblins destroyed that city many ages ago. This, Thorin, the rune's name Orcrist, the goblin cleaver in the ancient tongue of Gondolin. It was a famous blade. This, Gandalf, was Glamdring, foe hammer that the king of Gondolin once wore. Keep them well."
"Whence did the trolls get them, I wonder?"
said Thorin, looking at his sword with new interest.
I couldn't say, said Elrond, but one may guess that your trolls had plundered other plunderers, or come on the remnants of old robberies in some hold in the mountains of the north. I've heard that there are still forgotten treasures of old to be found in the deserted caverns of the mines of Moria, since the dwarf and goblin war.
Thorin pondered these words.
I will keep this sword in honour, he said. May it soon cleave goblins once again.
A wish that is likely to be granted soon enough in the mountains, said Elrond. But show me now your map. He took it and gazed long at it, and he shook his head, for if he did not altogether approve of dwarves and their love of gold, he hated dragons and their cruel wickedness, and he grieved to remember the ruin of the town of Dale and its merry bells, and the burned banks of the bright river running. The moon was shining in a broad silver crescent. He held up the map, and the white light shone through it.
What is this? He said. There are moon letters here, beside the plain runes which say 5 feet high the door and 3 may walk abreast.
What are moon letters? Asked the hobbit, full of excitement. He loved maps, as I've told you before, and he also liked runes and letters and cunning handwriting, though when he wrote himself it was a bit thin and spidery.
Moon letters are rune letters, but you cannot see them, said Elrond, not when you look straight at them. They can only be seen when the moon shines behind them, and what is more, with a more cunning sort, it must be a moon of the same shape and season as the day when they were written. The dwarves invented them and wrote them with silver pens, as your friends could tell you. These must have been written on a midsummer's eve in a crescent moon a long while ago.
What do they say? Asked Gandalf and Thorin together, a bit vexed, perhaps, that even Elrond should have found this out first, though really there had not been a chance before, and there would not have been another until goodness knows when.
Stand by the grey stone when the thrush knocks, read Elrond, and the setting sun with the last light of Durin's day will shine upon the keyhole.
Durin, Durin, said Thorin. He was the father of the fathers of the eldest race of dwarves, the Longbeards, and my first ancestor. I am his heir.
Then what is Durin's day? Asked Elrond.
The first day of the dwarves' new year, said Thorin, is, as all should know, the first day of the last moon of autumn on the threshold of winter. We still call it Durin's Day when the last moon of autumn and the sun are in the sky together. But this will not help us much, I fear, for it passes our skill in these days to guess when such a time will come again. That remains to be seen, said Gandalf. Is there any more writing?
None to be seen by this moon, said Elrond, and he gave the map back to Thorin. And then they went down to the water to see the elves dance and sing upon the midsummer's eve. The next morning was a midsummer's morning, as fair and fresh as could be dreamed, blue sky and never a cloud, and the sun dancing on the water. Now they rode away amid songs of farewell and good speed, with their hearts ready for more adventure, and with a knowledge of the road they must follow over the misty mountains to the land beyond. Chapter 4 Over Hill and Under Hill. There were many paths that led up into those mountains, and many passes over them. But most of the paths were cheats and deceptions, and led nowhere or to bad ends. And most of the passes were infested by evil things and dreadful dangers. The dwarves and the hobbit, helped by the wise advice of Elrond, and the knowledge and memory of Gandalf, took the right road to the right pass. Long days after they had climbed out of the valley and left the last homely house miles behind, They were still going up and up and up. It was a hard path and a dangerous path, a crooked way and a lonely and a long. Now they could look back over the lands they had left, laid out behind them far below.